Tonight we are exploring the mountain of education. And for many reasons, which I won't go into now, it'll become apparent tonight that education for me is a huge mountain. And so I wanted to bring you tonight the very best of the mountain of education. And I know that the three people that I have on the call tonight, they represent the very best in the mountain of education. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about them because their curriculum videos are so long, but I'm going to give you a little bit of their bio. It's also posted on my Facebook page. And as you know, when we finish all of the mountains, we'll be doing just an audio and ebook, and their bios will also be in there. But I just want to tell you a little bit about them. Our first panelist is Dr. George C. Bradley, and he has worked for over 35 years in higher education. He has served at the executive level as the Vice President for Academic Affairs, Vice President of Fiscal Affairs, Executive Vice President, and President at multiple institutions. Prior to his career as an administrator, Dr. Bradley held faculty posts at numerous institutions of higher education. He currently works with executives on issues of quality control, statistical analysis, and strategic planning. He continues to work in the academy, guiding students in their doctoral studies. He specializes in qualitative research and statistics. Dr. Bradley conducts synchronous and asynchronous training on leadership and evaluation of organizational outcomes. Welcome to the call, Dr. George Bradley.
Thank you very much.
Look, I know smart people, boy. Smart people. We next have his partner, his life partner, which is his wife, and that's Dr. Tina Marshall Bradley. And Dr. Tina Marshall Bradley serves as a researcher and educator, where her responsibilities include data reporting, management and analysis, as well as project management. She has served as a professor and administrator at several institutions throughout the United States and has reviewed education programs around the world. Her work includes being the founding dean of a school of education, a Fulbright Binational Fellow at American University in Cairo, Egypt, and an American Society of Engineering Education Fellow at NASA's Langley Research Center. During her career, she has written and managed over $2.5 million in research and program grants through state, federal, and private organizations to support her work in the areas of organizational innovation, effective uses of technology, and regulatory support in education. I want to welcome to the call Dr. Tina Marshall Bradley. Welcome to the call.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you on. And last but not least, we have Patricia Moultrie Goldsmith. She is on a mission in her 23 years as a servant leader of public education. Her passion is for all stakeholders in education to perpetuate excellence in the air, accountability, integrity, and respect for all children to discover their purpose and reach their full potential. The youngest of eight children, she is a graduate of Orangeburg-Wilkinson High School, in rural Orangeburg, South Carolina. She's a graduate of the University of South Carolina, Columbia, undergrad and graduate schools, receiving a BA in English and a cognitive and secondary education and a master's of education in educational administration. In addition, she has received certifications from South Carolina State University in the area of reading and literacy competencies. She's currently enrolled at Clemson University, pursuing an educational specialist degree in administration and supervision. Patricia has served in the capacity of secondary English instructor, middle school ELA instructor, and administrator at every level of public education, to include PK through 12, alternative, charter, and career and technology education. She has worked at the district level as a parental engagement coordinator, McKinney Veto liaison, and federal programs bookkeeper. Patricia describes herself as a problem solver and a team builder. She currently serves as principal of Manning High School in historic Manning, South Carolina. She is married to Vincent L. Goldsmith and has three sons, Xavier, Zachary, and Zion. I want to welcome to the call my youngest sister, Patricia Moultrie Goldsmith. Hi, Patricia.
Hey, hello.
How are you?
Great.
You can just be yourself tonight. You all can just be yourself because I know you.
Okay.
Yeah, you all can be yourself. This group, let me say this, this group really has become family, okay? And so even though we have, you know, 100 people that are registered for this call, it really has become family because we have been exploring these mountains for the last, really over the last month. And I think that education is so important. But I really want to thank you all for your time because I know how important time is. I want to start with you all tonight, and I want to ask you, because I don't even know if I know this story, even in reference to Patricia. And that is your story on how you got into, or what is your why of going into education? I mean, you had, you know, other options, but you chose somewhere along the line education. So I want to start out by asking, what is your background story of your why? And I'm going to start with Dr. Tina. Is it okay if we say Dr. Tina tonight?
No, you can actually say Tina. That's what my parents
named me. Okay, I'm going to say Dr. Tina. It helps me, all right? Tell us your background, your story about how your why of education.
Sure. Thanks so much for the question. Also, I always tell people, and this is true, the reason I got into education, because I am the consummate student. I honestly love learning, and I know that sounds cliche, but school fit me. I wasn't necessarily social. I wasn't good in athletics, but I did academics well. And when I said I did academics well, not just conforming to what structured school does, I just really embrace the whole notion of learning, which sometimes gets me in trouble because people have defined education as leading to something, an economic something, and learning for learning's sake really speaks to me. So at its very essence, that's why I went into education. I just do. I love all things education.
Wow. Patricia?
Yes. Well, you know, of course, I'm the youngest of eight, and my parents did not finish school. My father had a sixth grade education and my mother 11th. But for my father, it was an expectation that we all went to school. And he would say, I don't know how you're going, but you're going to go. And so the groundwork had been laid with me being the youngest, watching everybody else kind of go to school. And so I did not want to be a teacher. I said I would never be a teacher. I wanted to be a lawyer because I wanted to be like my sister. And so I was going to go to law school and I was going to be a lawyer until I registered for teacher cadet my senior year of high school. And we had to go to different grade levels. And I saw the disparities in education, even at 17, 18 years old. And I decided then that I would go into education. And so I just decided I was going to go into teaching, and I went into English, and then I just went into education and have been there ever since.
Wow. And Dr. George, what about you?
George, just call me George. really, I got into it as a labor of love and really wanting to serve and wanted to be a change agent. It's an interesting story. When my daughter graduated from Howard, she had an opportunity to go in the industry, or she had an opportunity to go into the Peace Corps. And I told her that the good ones always serve and that we always give back. And so having an opportunity to serve was a component of going into education, and having an opportunity to be a change agent, I know that I had to be a part of the administration to move things.
Wow. Well, I looked at, and it's funny, as long as I know Trisha all my life, because that's my sister, I didn't actually know you wanted to be a lawyer first. But one of the things that I've consistently heard, okay, we're going to go with George and Tina, okay? So one of the things I consistently heard when I've talked to all three of you over the years is your passion for education. I mean, not just I went in, even though that may not be initially, like Trisha said, what she wanted to do, but I've heard this passion for education, and I've seen it drive every single one of you. If you were to say to educators today, because we know that we have been studying and talking about leading through crisis, How would you define the crisis today as you see it from your perspective in education? And I know you can't solve the whole issue tonight, but what is one of the things that you think is critical in addressing the crisis in education? And George, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I'm going to have to stay on the level of higher education.
That's
and
fine.
I think one of one of the critical pieces in higher education is for our leadership to be able to pivot. We are training students for jobs that don't exist. And we have to have some of our best and brightest minds be a part of education. We have to be mindful that education is changing daily. And what we did 10 years ago is different now. So having a international view, being able to connect with industry, and when you see the changes moving in that direction, to have the emotional fortitude, the team, and to rally the community around you to pivot. I think it's very important to have that vision and to have that emotional fortitude to when you see things moving in a certain direction, that makes the making sure that we stay with the times.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that, because one of the issues that came up when we asked people the first night we started this was this issue of being able to pivot. What would you say to a person, other than that it's necessary, they have to pivot, what would you say to a person who says they have difficulty pivoting? What would you suggest to them?
You know, number one, I would communicate with them to get a certain mindset. I would tell them two things. First thing I would tell them is to build your dam while the waters are calm. And for when you have an opportunity to plan, to always think about the seventh generation and to have a mindset that we have to plant trees that we know that we'll never sit under. It's very important to have that mindset and to know that we're setting into progress things that we'll probably never see. And if you have some issues with thinking that way and gathering that mindset, you know, I think you probably need to adopt some mentors that you've seen that have been successful in that aspect, because it's a game skill, and it's nothing that you can tell a person right offhand. They have to be nurtured in that aspect.
Wow. That's good. That's good. Dr. Tina?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on that before I articulate a challenge that I see. And that is, you know, I was reflecting on there have been a couple of times when I've had to pivot for a variety of reasons, necessity, just whatever. And I think one of the things that I had to embrace, especially as educators, is sometimes we believe that we need to have all the answers or know everything. And so to me, being vulnerable and honest, that you're going to have to learn some new things. And it's scary. I always try to take on projects that stretch me, so I'll always know what my students are thinking, you know, are feeling. And I've done that ever since I taught in public schools. So, you know, the concepts that you teach year after year or over and over seem simple to you, but for somebody learning it for the first time, it's very difficult. And so that's what I always think when I have to pivot. This is something new, but it's a challenge. And like I've overcome challenges before, this is something that I can do also, which kind of feeds into what I believe is one of the most difficult challenges facing education, and that is that we don't use models of excellence. I was involved in a research project in the beginning of my career that asked the question, what is it that we're doing in educator preparation programs to teach teachers to be scientists? teachers. And essentially after, it was a very large study, but what it boiled down to is that there's nothing that we're doing, that basically teachers teach the way that they were taught, which is a little problematic, you know, and I'll give you a good example of this, not necessarily with teachers, but with the education system. And that is that we start school in the fall, sometime around August and September, and end at the end of spring, around April or May. And that's based on an agrarian society. We haven't been an agrarian society for a long time. And certainly some schools and some districts have, you know, toyed around with year-round school, but there still is this notion of operating in that way. Even though we've learned from other industries, there are better ways of doing this. Even in education, research shows there are better ways, but we have a tendency not to apply that research to actual practice.
Wow. So to catch up with what we actually need and actual practice, we basically have a system that we just continue to follow.
Exactly. As opposed to you using what we know, because we do engage in research. There have been studies upon studies, and I've got list of examples, unfortunately, of where studies, experts agree across periods of time, yet we still don't follow that in terms of applying it to our practice and the way that we do education.
Wow. Patricia, what do you see as in the secondary piece as the challenges?
Well, you know, there are many, but working and growing up in a rural area and being a part of the Carter of Shame in South Carolina, the equity, access, and opportunity for students is a major issue. And a lot of times others cannot see that. The good thing, and I know this is going to sound crazy, but the good thing about COVID-19 is that it's shown us the disparity. And so it's very evident when we speak of e-learning for students and students not having computers or not having the internet or not having access. So it shows us really where we are. I'm starting to journal pretty much things that I've learned from COVID-19, because there are lessons in everything. And so one of the things that I hear often is people will say, oh, I work in a Title I school, I work in a Title I school, and that really irritates me, because I'm going, what does that really mean? Because people equate that to poverty. Well, Title I just simply tells us how a child eats, not how they learn. And so we know that, okay, Title I, you know, they're coming from a high poverty area, but we assume a lot of times because someone comes from poverty that they can't learn, and that is not true. And so a lot of times those opportunities aren't made available to those students who could be our game changers. And there are jobs, there will be jobs that we are teaching kids for that don't exist, but part of the challenge is the fear of getting teachers and educators past the fear of letting kids take control of their learning. We are so determined to lecture and to talk and to talk and to talk and then what happens is we're the only one doing the learning. That is a problem why our students leave from us and go to higher education and they have problems thinking for themselves. And so they're going into colleges and universities in remediation. And so we have to change the way we do stuff. We have to allow children, because they really are bright, and we don't give them the credit that they deserve. They really are bright, and they're innovative, and they're inquisitive by nature. And if we would just be their guide instead of trying to tell them everything to do and tell them the answers, they're going to be our game changers. And so I tell my teachers all the time, we have to be able to monitor and adjust. And so if something happens and it doesn't work that way, we can't be afraid to say, hey, we tried it, it didn't work, let's try this. But I like to pull children in to ask them, because they will tell you the truth. I don't need to go into a classroom and sit down and do an observation for 40 minutes and have a teacher put on a horse and pony show. I know whether you're teaching or not, because I will ask the kids, what did you learn today? And they will tell you, and they will be honest. And so part of that pivot is just getting educators to release and to let go and to let children be the guide for their learning, and then just let us kind of help push them as opposed to telling them everything.
Wow. Wow. George and Tina, the piece that she said about how students are coming into higher education, and I heard another professor friend of mine said that one of the big challenges, especially initially when students are coming in their first year, is critical thinking. What has been your experience with that in higher education?
Tina, you want to start?
Sure, I do. I want to go back to a study that kind of speaks to what Patricia was saying that we conducted actually in South Carolina regarding African-American students and standardized testing. Essentially, we ran data on students, African-American students' performance on standardized testing across the state. And the conclusion that we came up with, because most at that time standardized testing was happening basically starting in the third grade and then again in the eighth grade and then at the high school level. But what we found is those districts that had high numbers of African-American students, their students scored higher in the third grade and almost comparable to other populations of students, but their scores went down in the eighth grade. And when George and I were talking about this, I said, George, you know, we can't publish, you know, this data, because basically it says the longer African-American students stay in school, the worse they get at doing school. And I said, well, you know, it could be that year's eighth graders were, you know, happened to be, you know, not as well developed as third graders, what have you. He's like, nope, the data are, you know, what they are. And so we published it in the state of South Carolina, published by the Columbia Urban League, and I just thought we were going to have a deluge of educators coming in saying, that's terrible, you know, that's wrong, you did something. But we had calls from a reporter from the state newspaper who said that matched some other research that she had done, that over a longitudinal study that said, as African Americans, the longer they stayed in school, the worse they got on, and help me, let me make sure I explain this, on school-related issues, and that is taking tests. That doesn't necessarily mean they were less intelligent or became less intelligent. It just meant that schools were failing this population. And schools didn't call us in. It was a parent group that called us in and asked us to explain the study and to help them understand what they could do better. So one of the things, and by the way, Patricia, these parents were from a poor community, and they wanted to know, you know, what their teachers can do better. So essentially, these parents are sending these wonderful, as Patricia said, they're intellectually curious. They do amazing, amazing things. And as educators, we are not capitalizing on that. We're trying to fit them into our version of what school is. And essentially, then we turn around. When they get to higher ed, we want them to think critically. When what we've done is almost stripped them of the critical thinking that they bring. So I concur with Patricia that as educators, we have to be the learners we want to see our students be. That means there are times we can learn from them, and then there are other times we facilitate the learning process as we go along.
Wow.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I haven't worked at the undergraduate level for some time. I've always been at the doctoral level. And believe it or not, we even have issues with critical thinking there at a doctoral level. When you would think to get into a doctoral program, you should have mastered that skill. But it's one thing I've always, when I had an opportunity to talk with young folks, I always tell them, that all of us can soar. Some of us might need a longer runway.
Mm-hmm. I like that, George.
We just need a longer, some of us might need a longer runway.
I like that. That's going in the book, George. I like that. Yeah. Explain that. I mean, I think I know what you mean, but explain that.
You know, I was probably one of those students that probably didn't have the best grades in high school. But when I got to college, I had a great support system. And a lot of my professors told me where I had some deficiencies, and I was willing to work. I was willing to put in the time. And I don't care how smart you are, that you're going to always have challenges in areas, whether it's emotional, physical, cognitively. And when you see weaknesses or things that you need to work on, you need to have the emotional fortitude to move in that direction and put the time in. Because nobody's perfect and nobody's proficient in every area. There are always these things to where you need to reach. And you show me a person that has failed and got back up, I'll put my money on that person who they would claim has all of the academic skills but has never gone through a hardship.
Well, you've led us right into our next question, because when we started this series, one of the things that we found was common among participants, you know, on this call, is that several people said that they were afraid, they wanted to get over the fear of failure. And, you know, I believe that success is on the other side of failure. So I'd like for you to pick up with that, George, and then we'll go down to Tina and then Patricia. And how do you give us an example of some point of when you've experienced failure, and how did you get up and move past that?
You know, I really believe failure is a part of growth and being successful. I've always been a slow starter, even in athletics. I started slow, and but that will to win and that desire to do better has always made me practice and has motivated me to move forward. I've failed at several things. And I think in my career, one of the things that probably I'm still scarred by is I had an opportunity when I was picking my executive team. I picked a bad vice president of academic affairs, and I just blew it. I mean, I blew it. That person did not have the skill set that I thought was necessary to help us accomplish our mission and move toward our vision. And I had to make a move on that person. I had to let him go. And, you know, I realized what I learned from that I needed to actually see evidence of traits that I was looking for in a team. And I need to make sure that person was motivated and could grow. There are several, but, you know, failure has always motivated me and inspired me to be better. You know, starting at an early age in athletics, and I have always embraced failure as a way to excellence. You know, it's an old Vince Lombardi saying, winning is not everything. Shucks, it's the only thing. I've never read a book on how to lose, on how to fail.
Wow.
But saying that, I know there are times when I'm going to fail, but I work and do my best to make sure it's not the same mistake twice. But I think it's a motivator, because if you don't fail, you won't learn. And you're going to fail many times. You're going to probably fail more than you're going to be successful. But those are building blocks to move you to another level.
Wow. And Tina, how do you process failure?
And interestingly enough, I think I'm on the other side of failure from George, especially in the area of academics. And like I started off saying, I really did. I embraced all things learning. And so my natural style fit into the things that were rewarding in school for the most part. But, you know, and I'm so glad you asked this question, because it wasn't until, believe it or not, you know, recently, and by the way, I'm probably in the fall, a little closer to the winter of my, you know, working career, and I realized, I was having this discussion, actually with my family, that I'm really, really successful at a lot of things. But one of the reasons I think that I am is because I only engage in things that I almost know that I'm going to be successful at. So those things that I don't think that I'm going to be successful at, I have a tendency to shy away from. That's not a good thing, and it's very hard. It's very, very scary, especially if you are used to being successful. So these are your students who are high flyers, right? We think that high flyers, you know, we don't need to pay attention to them. But we do, because there's this notion of low expectations. So you're always successful because you never stretch. You never go after, you know, the big deals, the big ideas, the big things, because you're afraid of failure. And so accepting that, and by the way, every time, it comes, it feels the same way, it's not a good feeling. Sometimes you win and, sometimes you don't. But the whole range of emotions, are extremely important. I always think about the fact that when I think of a heart monitor, it goes up and down, right? So you have, there are times that you win and there are times you lose. If it flatlines, if there's a straight line, whether it's high or low, that still means you're dead. So life is about those wins and those losers. But if the opportunities, don't hang out and hang on your wins, all the time. But also don't stay in the valleys, where the losses are also. And, as we were talking about this question, I have so many examples of times that I've failed. But I did realize that I needed to work on making sure that I stretched myself to go after those things, even if I didn't think that I was going to make it. And then apply some of those other principles, working hard, seeking assistance, the other kinds of things in order to increase the probability that I'd be successful.
Thank you, Tina. That is really powerful, because you could have actually students, even within our classes, who are doing well academically, but they don't really stretch themselves to go to that next place because they're used to being successful. And
that's
so
right.
this is really critical. Patricia, how do you process failure?
I'm not very good at it at all, because I don't like to lose and I'm not used to losing. And so I'm a sore loser. I am. And so I don't process it well. I don't. I don't know if anybody else on this call is like that, but I'm a little different. And just one particular time, I'm always used to, and I don't know whether it comes from being the youngest of eight and just kind of being a little spoiled, but I'm kind of used to having what I want and getting what I want and being able to do it. Well, a couple of years ago, I was slated for this position, which was a director's position, and then some things turned around and I didn't get it. And so I found myself out of work for like about 3-4 months. And it was mind-boggling. But my mom always, would tell us, everything that happens for a reason, and there's a lesson in it. And you have to learn the lesson. And so no matter how bad it seems, you have to learn the lesson in it. And so, I was mad. I was mad for a while. I was playing video games. I was just like, okay, I'm just not going to do anything. I don't know what I'm going to do. Because I could always teach and I could always do different things, but it was just nothing that I really wanted to do. And I just became kind of, I was just disappointed. And I was like, I'm just not going to do anything. And then I realized that was only going to last so long because I had 3 children. And so I just couldn't sit and do that. And so, as I said, I had time to just really think. Well, I received a phone call from someone that I used to work with, and we didn't worked together very closely, but we worked in the same arena. And she said, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm not doing anything. And she said, well, I want you to come and work in federal programs. And I said, I don't know anything about federal programs. I don't know anything about finance. It's the one area I hate the most, because I've always surrounded myself with people who knew those areas well, so I didn't have to be the expert necessarily in those areas. And she said, I'm going to teach you. And I was afraid to even delve into that, because I did not want to deal with finance. And I knew federal programs, you know, there was a lot of accountability and oversight, and I was just like, Well, I wound up stepping into that and just really enjoying it. And I learned so much, and I learned so much about myself and just about people. But I realized that I had to have that time, which I would consider a failure for me, because I wasn't used to that. And so it was very much so out of my comfort zone. And it allowed me to be able to be empathetic to other people. So when I worked with McKinney Vento, when I worked with homeless parents and homeless kids, I wasn't so judgmental about what I saw. Like, why doesn't that parent do such and such and such? Realizing this parent is doing the best they can, but they're having a hard time, and this is why. And then it allowed me to see some things differently, which I realized going back to it, those are the lessons that I needed in order to move forward, because it allows me, even as a principal, to be empathetic to students and even to teachers. Because if you don't take care of your people can't take care of you, your people can't take care of kids. And so it's a trickle-down effect. So my failure, what I would consider my biggest failure, has really been my biggest blessing, because it's allowed me to be a better leader and to work with people and to empathize, to know how to help them to move forward.
Wow. Go ahead, George.
Okay. It's a book that I read some time ago. It's called A Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns. And it's really about Abraham Lincoln taking people who were his opponents and building a nation. But it's an excellent book, basically talking about a lot, how many times Lincoln lost before he became president. And there were several.
Wow. A Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns?
Yes. Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns.
Great. Thank you. George, you've worked, because you're in higher education. You've been, you've led a university, been president of a university. You've done a lot in the fiscal areas. You've dealt with stakeholders. Various stakeholders, board of directors, the professors, parents, et cetera. Tell us about how to work with various stakeholders as a leader. When you enter into a certain leadership position, a leadership role, the mindset you have to come into when you're working with stakeholders, various stakeholders.
Well, the most important thing in dealing with stakeholders is the number one, have a strategic plan. And what I mean by a strategic plan, I'm going to start from the top. You need to have a vision. You need to understand your mission. You need to have your strategic goals and understand the strategic objectives. You need to understand that you need to be grounded in your guiding principles. And these things are called your navigational tools. And a lot of these things will be predicated on historical information and data and where higher education is going. But basically, when you have those components together, when you are in tune with your objectives that will help you accomplish your goals, when your goals come together and help you accomplish your mission, and when you're successful with your mission, you can move towards your vision, you can sit up and communicate intelligently with any constituent. But not having a plan and not being in tune with those navigational tools will make you look scattered.
Let me ask you, what about the person who's here that says, you know, I'm just a teacher, or I'm just a professor, or I'm not in the higher levels of education. What would you say to that person?
I would tell that person that every component of every job there, from the custodian to the painter to the cafeteria person,
mm-hmm.
is a component that's helping you move and accomplish that mission. Faculty teachers provides the intellectual resources that are central to moving higher education and public schools. No institution is ever any better than their teachers or professors. But every component on that campus or school is important for accomplishing your mission. So no position there is meaningless. Everything is a building block toward moving towards your vision and accomplishing your mission.
Yep.
Okay,
I love that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Tina.
Can I build on that? Yeah, I actually.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
A course called Teacher Leadership. And one of the things that I noticed the first time I taught this course is that teachers, the first thing that they had to do was identify a challenge. And they would always say, you know, I'm interested in this and I'm interested in that, but my principal or my superintendent. And the genesis of the course, you know, I asked them to go back and read the first statements from the book. Because the first thing that they say is anybody and everybody, anybody can be a leader. So there are two myths to tell. Number one, that leaders are born, leaders are not, leaders are made. And it involves people throughout any organization. So anybody can be a leader. And working together to accomplish something that matters is what leadership is. So the first thing, there are five things to think about. Number one, define yourself as a leader. You don't positions don't define leadership. Individuals who lead define what leadership is. Cultivate emotional intelligence. You know, having people say no, having people disagree with you. You know, not making it personal when, you know, people don't necessarily want to go in your direction are all a part of leadership. Foster trust with individuals that are around you, and that is your colleagues, individuals who are in different positions, maybe managerial or executive positions, as well as people like your clients in a school district, the superintendent and principal, but also other teachers, as well as students and their families. Foster trust among all of those groups, and then engage with others. Engage with others from a place of respect, you know, regardless of, like I said, what your position is or what you're trying to do. Foster trust in the people that you're working with. And then something that I think that is very important, and that is adopting a global mindset. And, you know, many times you're saying, you know, well, I'm you know, sitting here in Richland School District 1, you know, what does that have to do with the world? But I think this coronavirus has shown us that it has everything. Adopting a global mindset is extremely important, and it's extremely important during these days and times. So we've seen leaders rise up from different areas, children, families, individuals who live in poverty, just all facets of life. So I think the idea that we demonstrate leadership, and then we also help others to become leaders, and that they spread across any organization, any community, any family to develop these very important skills.
Wow, that is great. Patricia, what is your thought about stakeholders, engaging all stakeholders?
It's mandatory. I mean, there's no way that I can do everything as a principal. So one of the things going in as a high school principal, especially because you have high school kids, 17, 18, you have to include them in the process. And everybody I've learned just wants to be heard. And when they're heard, it makes a difference. Right now, we're in the process of trying to plan graduation. And we don't know how we're going to do it because I have over 200 graduates. And while we want to respect the process and want those things that families want and parents want, we're dealing with a whole other component. So one of the things I've had to do was to send out surveys, just to survey kids, students, former graduates, so I could just get a holistic view. It's important. If trust is not there, it's the foundation of all things. And I've learned that whenever I say I'm going to do something, then I have to follow through with it. Because I tell teachers and students alike all the time, you want to be respected, not necessarily liked, and there's a difference. But I try to pull all of those people in, even teachers where I know if I say up, they say down. If I say blue, they say green. They're always opposite, and they're pushing. I embrace those people because I need to pull them in, and I try to figure out, okay, why whenever I say something, you always do such and such and such and such. But to pull them in and to make them a part of that team, and so they can see it from a different point of view, it also helps. So I love pulling different people in. I love pulling the naysayers in because you learn a different point of view. It allows you to think differently and just sometimes to understand why people believe things the way they do. But sometimes those people inside of an environment, inside of a culture, can totally tear your culture apart. So I try to pull them in and keep them near and just kind of work with them to see, okay, why do you believe this? Why do you believe that? But engaging stakeholders, especially at this level, is very important. It's very important. And so it can be challenging, but it's very necessary.
Great. For the three of you, and you can all just jump in, what do you think, you know, as leaders, because you start talking about, and that's what we're talking about, is leading people. And, you know, really knowing who you are, I believe, before you start leading people, self-leadership is important. But give us at least one or two leadership principles that you learned and that you've applied over the years that contribute to your success. When you think about it, you know, what leadership principles have I applied over the years that has led to my success? Whoever wants to go first.
I'll jump in. This is Tina. So the first leadership principle that I think is very important, you know, to me and actually to people that I consider to be leaders is integrity. And people, you know, kind of sometimes throw that, you know, word around. But integrity are things like when you make a mistake, say you've made a mistake. If you made the wrong call or didn't do something, it does a lot for your team for you to say, you know, I'm sorry, I should have done something, you know, different. It does not diminish your leadership capabilities at all. The second principle that I believe has helped me is transparency. As much as possible with whatever it is that I'm doing, I try to be transparent with individuals. Decisions that I've made, whether they're popular or not, helping people to understand why I made those decisions, understanding that within the context of very complex organizations that we work in, people are looking at issues from their lens. And as a leader and a decision maker, there are times that you have to make decisions. So you may listen to everyone, you try your best to understand the position of everyone, but then there are times that you have to make a decision. But helping people understand what went into that decision, I think, is extremely important. And then the third principle is that actions speak louder than words. And that may sound cliche, but at the end of the day, our focus on outcomes as opposed to processes, I believe, is very important. We need to have processes. We need to formulate a plan, you know, come up with ideas, and then implement them. and then actually examine, you know, did we meet our, you know, our goal or objective? If not, what did we do or not do that we can change so that we are able to do things, either accomplish something or do things better? So those are the three areas, the three principles: integrity, transparency, and the idea that action speaks louder than words.
Wow. George?
Well, mine might deviate a little bit from Tina's. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it might deviate.
I can hear you.
You know, one of the principles that I just believe in being successful and moving forward, you have to have good people. And you have to treat your people fair. You have to be treat your people fair, and you have to be transparent. I believe in having a plan. I just think it's essential, and I believe in accountability. I believe in inspecting what I expect. Inspect what I expect. And those components I've kind of kept with me as I moved through higher education.
Wow. Patricia.
It's just interesting because my motto this year going in is accountability, integrity, and respect. And so those are the things that I stand on. And when I explained accountability, I mean accountability to each other. We have to be accountable to each other. And if I'm not doing something, you know, I need somebody to say to me, hey, Patricia, let me talk to you for a second. I don't need people to let me keep going in a wrong direction, but to have conversation. Integrity, I've always just believed that you have to stand on something. You have to stand up for what you believe in. A lot of times it's probably gotten me into a little trouble, because I've had to learn how to be vocal with people who don't necessarily agree that are in a higher position than I am, just to get them to try to understand. But again, like Tina said, people see things from their lens. And so as I'm learning as I grow, and just be respectful of other people. I, you know, that'll take you farther where money and other things can't. And so I believe in those values. And so at the core of everything, I think those three principles, guide everything that I do with respect to just children and educators is accountability, integrity, and respect.
Great. Now, Trish, I know that you have worked with early in your career, you worked at, or was principal of an at-risk school, correct?
Yes.
That were at risk?
Yes.
Tell us, because sometimes, you know, and now we have teachers, we have educators and various people in the educational system who say, you know, they can't do their job because, you know, of parents, because of the homes children come from. You have some very interesting things, I know, when you were in that process where children may not be, or students may not be in the best of home situations. How did you handle that as an educator?
It's about relationships. And it all stems from relationships. I enjoyed working at the alternative level because what I realized is those children, while they may have different situations, when they're angry, when they're cussing and fussing, when they are lashing out, I found out 99% of the time it has nothing to do with me. And they have, a lot of times, just don't have anybody that listens. They're from home to home. They travel with bags. They have a lot of baggage, and they don't feel like people understand, and they can't relate. And a lot of times I would tell them, you know, I can't fully relate to that. But I can listen, and I don't have the answer to everything, but I can try to help you work through it, because a lot of times they can't see past where they are. And one of the biggest things about working in an alternative setting is simply providing hope. If children can see somebody believes in them and there's some hope, they'll keep going. but they do believe what you do, not so much what you say. And an example would be when I took a group, and I had more boys than I had girls, and I took them to a ropes course. And, you know, they were getting up there and they were crying and they were like, get me down, get me down. And one boy said, well, you know, I don't see you up there. You know, you busy telling us to get up there, but I don't see you. And I was like, oh, I can get up there. You know, oh, I can. And I was thinking, what am I saying? And, you know, I'm not a little girl. So I was like, okay, let me, you know, but if I didn't do it, I was thinking, if I don't do this, he's not going to believe anything else that I say. So, and I was scared. And so I got up there. I got up there and I was praying as I walked across that street and holding on to that rope. But I was thinking, if this thing lets me fall. And when I got to the end and we had to do a zip line, the instructor said, if you want to really impress them, go backwards. And I did. And I was afraid and I went backwards. And when I got down to the ground, and he was one of my hardest kids, he said, I'll do anything you ask me to do from now on. And I said, well, why? He said, because you actually got up there and did what you wanted us to do. And I learned then I would never ask people to do things that I'm not willing to do. So in an educational setting, if, you know, I need to sweep the floor or I need to mop the floor or I need to help take care of a kid, then that's what I do. I tell people all the time, don't let the degrees fool you. This is not where I've come from. It's just what I've amassed over the years. And so when people see that, and especially kids, they're able to respect it. And alternative, you know, children in an alternative setting are there simply because of things that have happened around them. And a lot of times they just need support and need to know the resources to help them move forward.
Wow. Wow. That is awesome. We have so many challenges, you know, in the educational system, in the family. I want you to talk to the three of you to talk to people who come into, they're in the educational system. They've gone to school, they've gotten their degrees, et cetera, and they've become disenchanted with the process. They've become disenchanted with education. They just don't see the hope that Patricia was talking about. They don't necessarily see it. And they come into a culture, and I know all of you have experienced this, where you come into either a brand new situation and there's a culture established. How do you help? What do you say to those people who, you know, they become disenchanted in the educational field? They feel like, I've gone to school, I've done this, I've done that. And they're disenchanted because of their experiences, because the lack of resources. What would you say to those people? Tina, I'm going to start with you.
I was one of those individuals. I actually went to school and majored in education. I trained to be a teacher, and when I got my first position, I failed miserably. I mean miserably. And but the difference is, I knew it was clear that I had not been trained properly. I did not know what I was doing. And I was fortunate enough in my third year that we moved from South Carolina to Florida. And the school that, the elementary school where I taught, was literally within walking distance of Bethune-Cookman College at that time. And they were running a professional development series across a year. And I met some of the foremost thinkers in education. And it just really was. I was in the right place at the right time. And they helped me understand the context of my work, some helped me understand who I was, you know, as you know, an individual. And, you know, as I was working, I was very disenchanted with administrators. So I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll help to change education by becoming an administrator. Halfway through my studies, and by the way, this is why some of the reasons that I got extra degrees, trying to, you know, move into positions where I thought I could affect change. And halfway through my studies, I said, oh, my goodness, as an administrator, I'm not necessarily going to be able to do the things that I want with students. So mm-hmm. perhaps if I become, if I work in higher education, I help to develop these teachers, I can affect change. But along the way, I learned that you affect change where you are and in the environment. And like I said, you don't have to be dubbed with a certain position, you know, in order to affect change. We still, George and I still do work with public school students, not as our job. But when opportunities present themselves, you know, we do. We know things, you know, about education. So a lot of times, you know, we talk about that critical thinking. That's even important after you leave. It's important in all aspects of everybody's life to think differently and to affect those kinds of change. And to me, those individuals who have become disenchanted, we need to help them find what they want to do, where they want to be. A lot of times, if you see people who they may say that the reason they're they don't have the resources, etc. If you look deep, it's probably because they might be on the right bus, but they may be in the wrong seat. And so we have to find, or they might be on the wrong bus also. So we have to help them find their place wherever that may be.
You're right. George, what would you say to those people? Just be quiet. What would you say to those people who are disenchanted at this point?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. Tina and I are on the same sheet of music with that. You know, we're involved in different ways in education and public schools. And when we talk with a lot of our friends and our colleagues who have problems and issues with certain things, you know, we talk about it. We ask them to get involved, to try to understand the environment, to get to know the teachers, to get to know the administrators, and to find some way that they can serve so that they can be a part of it. Because sitting on the outside complaining, you won't accomplish a thing.
That's it. Trisha? Because you start laughing at the bus.
Well,
you know, that's
yeah,
big thing.
It's funny because, you know, I've invited people to get off the bus sometimes. it's not an area for the faint of heart. I mean, it's just not. And there have been times just in my 23 years when I'm just going, you know, God, this is not what I was meant to do. You know, surely there is something else that I was meant to do, because it does get frustrating and it becomes overwhelming a lot of days. What I started doing, because I realized that that my successes with children a lot of times was long-term, because they couldn't see things right then that we were trying to do for them, or teachers couldn't see it, or different people. I keep a treasure chest in my office, and so whenever I get a little card or just a little note or something like that, I put it in there and I go back to those things. And that is what helps keep me going, because I realize, okay, you know, I may not be everything to everybody, but I'm something to somebody. And so I'm helping somebody in this. So whenever I start going, you know, I don't think this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And that happens often. Okay. If anybody tells you that they have it all together, is educated, they're lying. Because it becomes overwhelming and frustrating where you feel like you just don't, you can't see where you're making a change. Because for everybody who, you know, is being successful, you feel like I failed this person, or this didn't happen, or somebody's blaming me for this. But you, part of it is you have to kind of keep yourself going. You have to kind of surround yourself with other people that can help you to keep moving. And then for some people, it just may not be where they need to be in that area. They can affect change other places. It may not be actually in the classroom. It may be someplace else doing something else that affects children. And so you just have to kind of find that spot that kind of works for you.
Wow. So the three of you, I'd like for each of you to do your closing statement. Just the thing that you want people to learn, to leave people with tonight in reference to education. We have people on the line who are, you know, in collegiate level. Some people are in secondary education. Some people, you know, they're in various places within that spectrum. What would be your closing remarks to those people tonight? George, we'll start with you.
Well, believe it or not, when I'm asked this question, I normally just leave with a poem. I can state my poem now, or I can state it later.
Go for it.
Well, the poem goes like this. One ship went east and another ship went west under the same self wind that blows. It is the set of the sail and not the gale that determine which way the ship goes. How can one ship go east and another one goes 180 degrees in the same wind? It's not the wind. It is the set of your sail. It's your work ethic. It's your skill set. It's your diligence that determines which way your ship will go.
Thank you very much. All right, Tita. That was excellent.
I was going to say, I think the one thing that I would say, you know, in terms of being a leader in education is to lead where you are. As I articulated before, I honestly do believe that everybody is a leader. The issue is identifying an area where you would like to make a difference, and then just make a difference in that particular area.
Wow. Patricia?
I would say to anyone who's in education or thinking about coming into education, just hold on, because the students really do need you. They need your expertise. They need your vulnerability. They need to know that it is possible, and they need to know what is possible. Some days are harder than others, but I think above all else, it's most definitely worth it. I just want people to continue to pour into young people and to help them along the way. And when you get frustrated, just try to dig into something deeper to help keep pushing you along. But it is well worth it, and the kids are worth it.
Thank you so much. I want to thank our panelists tonight, George, Tina, Patricia. Thank you so much.